Ja, dann beginne ich einmal, dear ladies and gentlemen. Today is my special honor to introduce two speakers. Together they will introduce us to a central figure of Oriental and Islam studies and illuminate him from different biographical and conceptual perspectives. The speaker in question is Ignaz Goldzier. Our first speaker is Professor Rüdiger Lolka. Rüdiger Lolka is a scholar of Islam since 2003. He is University Professor of Oriental Studies at the University of Vienna, and his research focus include Islamic thought in modernity and Islamic law. Our second speaker is the world-renowned Judaist Professor Susanne Heschel. She has served as Elie Black Professor of Jewish Studies at the Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, USA, since 2005. One of her special works is the book called Jewish Islam, in which she explores the questions and examines to what extent there is a specifically German-Jewish Orientalism and to what extent the mutual attractions of Judaism and Islam can change our understanding of European Orientalistic. Dear Professor Lolka, we're going to start with you.
Okay. Thank you very much for this kind invitation, and hopefully you won't despair when I start talking. Nevertheless, it's a pleasure and honor to speak, as you said, about one of the founding fathers of my discipline, Islamic studies. Without Ignaz Goldzier, there wouldn't be Islamic studies at all, in Europe at least. But maybe it's very important for our discipline, and he has been one of the most outstanding scholars in the 19th and 20th century in the study of Islam in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Ignaz Goldzier, to give some basic, I won't talk too much about his biography, data. He was born in June 1850, died in 1921, Christian era. I'm saying Christian era, not common era. That's a long discussion. Nevertheless, I love to disturb my dear colleagues with some heretic remarks. Okay, remarks. I have to start with a one or three or four preliminary remarks to introduce you to my approach I use in this lecture. First remark, I have to join the contemporaries of Ignaz Goldzier, who complained about his many works locked in the chains of a mysterious language, Hungarian. I have to admit, I do not know Hungarian, a few words maybe, but not being able to read the writings of Goldzier in Hungarian. So thus I will have to reframe myself to the non-Hungarian parts of his oeuvre. Sorry for that one. The few translated articles are very interesting and worth reading, I'm sure, but I'm afraid I'm just now trying to improve my Bahasa Indonesia, not my Hungarian. Okay, maybe when I'm retired, I'm going to Budapest to learn. It may be interesting that some of his writings on Islam in Hungarian were written for a general audience who should be interested, as to Ignaz Goldzier, to know something about Islam, since Bosnia-Herzegovina has become part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and a sizable minority of Muslims were living in the empire, and Hungary was part of it. Thus, it should be of interest for at least some Austro-Hungarian people. But these writings were later translated into Bosnian. Obviously, among Bosnians, there was also a lack of knowledge of Hungarian. So I'm very happy I'm not the only one who has to admit doesn't know Hungarian. But at least this translation will reflect to some extent the acceptance of his ideas among Muslims. They were translated in his lifetime into Bosnian. Thus, it's an interesting case. The second remark is a much more personal one, being a student of Iranian studies, among other disciplines. Many years ago, I once met an Iranian student telling me about his father, who was persecuted in the Islamic Republic of Iran because he translated Golzia into Persian. Golzia himself taught Persian, by the way. Many other languages. Okay. And his father was accused of being a Zionist spy. So the argument runs: Iranian, more or less Muslim, translating a Jew, writing on Islam, he has to be an Israeli spy. Quite impeccable logic, if we do have over there. He survived, by the way, this kind of persecution. Knowing at that time, even at that time, that Golzia was not a Zionist and at odds to some extent with the Jewish community in Budapest, I think Susanna Heschel will be talking about it a little bit later on. It makes him a quite interesting case for a curious student. I have to admit I was at that time. We should acknowledge there has been a certain anti-Golzia stance among Muslims, Sunni, not only Shiite Muslims, also among Sunni Muslims. Case at hand, it's Mustafa Sibai or Muhammad al-Ghazali and others could be named. But this kind of critique was due to intra-Muslim debates, opposing to a critical stance by an Egyptian scholar. Third remark. When I was asked several years ago to write an article on Taqiyya in German, I started to research, research literature, sources, etc. And by surprise, I stumbled upon Ignaz Golzia, who published in 1906 the first article on Taqiyya in German language. So if in Islamic study you start to research, you will stumble upon Ignaz Golzia. That's quite revealing, at least maybe not the best of my discipline. Nothing new after Golzia. Hopefully not. Fourth remark. Many times, many years ago, when I met a dear colleague from Jewish studies, it's not you, I'm afraid, another one, we learned again and again when giving lectures that the Jewish scholarly tradition and the Islamic one do show astonishing similarities regarding the arguments, the way of arguing, even the topics discussed. We easily found out there are similarities. Even I remember we once discussed a project on humor, Jewish and Islamic humor. Wasn't realized, unfortunately. A lot of jokes never told among us, but at least there's some time to go. This makes me think we do not need Christian Islamic or Jewish Christian dialogue, but somewhat more Jewish Islamic dialogue. Or on a more global level, a kind of global multi-logue, especially if we are talking about pre-modern cultures. Maybe it's in need of a global dialogue or multi-logue nowadays, for sure. But we can't delve into that one. But let us turn to Galicia. I will start, at least. Please excuse. Apologies from a professor who feels distracted too many times. Here, Dugolzia wrote a very interesting diary, published in German, not in Hungarian. Praise be God, to God. It's really in German. I'm able to read it. And in there is a precious story that may help us to understand not the worldview, but the practice of Galicia, a practice we may call humanistic, since it's including all of humanity through its languages. And it tells a lot about this self-awareness of Galicia as being a genius, to some extent. He writes, Galicia, in an entry of his diary dated August 31, 1894, when he traveled to Fribourg in Switzerland in the company of one member of the White Fathers missionary order of the Catholic Church, active in many regions of the world. You may have heard about four members killed some years ago in Algeria during Algerian civil war. This very tragic story. But he traveled with this member of the Père Blanc who was living in Northern Africa and who was living in close contact with the people of the Maghreb and speaking Maghrebi Arabic. And Galicia was talking to him in Maghrebi Arabic, for sure. Just another language. And they were conversing about many different issues, and the Christian monk thought Galicia was a Muslim because he was defending Islam with arguments on a, as Galicia tells us, correct interpretation. So sure, and the interpretation of Galicia has to be correct because it's his. Correct understanding of the Quran. A lady from Geneva, another traveler, remarked she noticed from the beginning that Galicia was no European due to his oriental traits and his way of moving. I don't have an idea what this means at all, but okay. But then she was surprised that Galicia was talking in Dutch to the conductor, talking to her in French, and us and to the monk in his, as she assumed, mother tongue, that's Arabic. She asked if Galicia knows English. Responding, Galicia says he sometimes even uses his real first language, Hungarian. And even to make things worse, he told her, I'm a Jew. She wasn't amused at all, being confused. A multilingual person and being a Jew and looking not like a European or whatever. I don't know. There are many other stories in this diary I would love to tell, but I'm afraid I only have a limited time here. And thus, I have to return to the immense productivity of Galicia. We are told he wrote 807 books, articles, and reviews, but we have to adjust this blunt statement to reality. Galicia's books are sometimes small booklets. There it is. For instance, his Beiträge zur Geschichte der Sprachgelehrsamkeit bei den Arabern. Sorry. It's about Arabic languages, Arabic language literature. And He published in 1871 the first volume, a small one, only 47 pages. Not a book, really a book nowadays, but at least at his time it was quite interesting, giving densely written with many quotations in Arabic and some comparative remarks in Hebrew. It is a true scholarly treatise, we might say, of a kind that contributed to the fame of Goldseer as an outstanding Arabist. There have been many publications in this series, his Beiträge series, with dealing with interesting authors of the classical Arabic literature and Islamic literature. Yeah, at the same time, we have to say it, he is drawing on sources available to him at his time. Sure, nowadays we fortunately do have more Islamic scholarship available at our hands in editions, many editions during the 20th and 21st century. But he wrote, for instance, about other issues, especially I really love his fine remarks on the limited knowledges of the scholars of Islamic law concerning the rules of Arabic grammar. So it's the remarks he is quoting from a work of a Shafi'i scholar of Islamic law, An-Nawawi, died in 1277, Christian era, and then 13th century. Even the knowledge of Arabic was poor to some extent. Even, we know, 100 years later, the complaints of an Andalusi scholar complaining that the Imams of Andalus in his time are not able to talk in Arabic at all. Okay, well, it's a complaint all over Islamic history up to today. But what makes it interesting, these remarks interesting, is the call for a critical study of the Quran or any other discipline of Islamic knowledge has to be more specific, since a critical view of other disciplines was inherent in Islamic scholarly tradition. Even from the beginning on, we do have the first centuries of Islamic history, many instances of critique of other scholars, a critical view, maybe somewhat sometimes deeply imbued with spirit of Jadal, maybe roughly to be translated as critique and polemics, inspired many parts of the of Islamic knowledge and the works produced in the classical and post-classical time. Here we may join Goldseer and his need to reading Arabic and Islamic sources, not talking about Islamic and Arabic sources by reading secondary research literature. That's quite a methodological challenge to my discipline up to now. I have to leave out an interesting aspect of the interesting aspect of scholarly exchange in times before the internet. Goldseer was busy writing postcards, letters, whatever. There is a large database at Budapest with about 30,600 documents written by to Goldseer, especially not more. And there are other parts of his correspondence available in other parts of the world. But what's most interesting maybe today is his lengthy trips to Istanbul, Damascus, and Cairo in the 1870s. Goldseer became acquainted during these trips, and I may dare to say he fell in love with Islam during this trip. As Josef von Es wrote, quote, immediately contact with the Islamic world was a rare thing at this time. German Orientalist, Josef von Es is a German, did normally not travel to the Near East. Before 1871, the country was too poor and too fragmented before the unification of Germany, and that for that kind of endeavor. Goltzia, however, belonged to a different tradition, and that's the Austrian one. That's what we're talking, what we are talking about. Under the Habsburg monarchy, Orientalists had become accustomed to a more practical understanding of their business. Josef von Hammerburgstall died in 1856, Christian era, had been trained as a language boy, in German is Sprachknabe, in Istanbul, and Alfred von Kramer, died in 1889, Christian era, had worked for some 30 years in the consular service of the Austrian Empire in Alexandria, Cairo, Beirut, and elsewhere. He is one of another important Islamic studies scholar, wrote a very interesting and still worth reading book on the history of Islamic culture. Goltzia happily agreed to travel to Syria and Egypt and to learn the colloquial languages. Evidently, remembering this trip to Fribourg, at least, surprisingly, he even learned Maghrebi Arabic in the Mashrek. Sometimes it's confusing, maybe in another occasion. Goltzia evidently did not comply with the duty put upon him to study the bureaucratic methods in the European consulates, but that was written down in the orders for his travel to the region. But he was much more interested in talking to Syrians, to Egyptians, whoever he came across, for sure, in looking for Arabic manuscripts and not interested at all in bureaucratic procedures in Austrian consulate in Beirut, for instance. He was not interested at all. But let us return to his diary to get an idea of his experience in Syria and in Cairo. The diary was written after his 40th year of age. That's quite after his travel to Syria and Egypt. Thus of a more mature age. Maybe it's a little bit more balanced to some extent as it would have been if he had written it in his 20s. It's speculation. He wrote, he said, his trip in 1873 and 74, during his, quote, Oriental, my Muslim year, he said. Goltzia mentions a special diary committed to his travels, but unfortunately it was not available to me. Thus, I will not talk about it. He mentioned his triumphal welcoming in Beirut for his knowledge of Arabic and of Islamic disciplines, etc. Very lengthy part of his diary. He was very happy of being welcomed, especially for his excellent knowledge in Arabic. His ultimate aim, but was not being a kind of interpreter like his predecessor Josef von Hammerburgstall was. That was not, and his Hungarian superiors had in mind to him, for him to become a very good interpreter in Arabic. But he had in mind to be like the Dutch Orientalist Christian Snoeckhorne, who died in 1936, Christian era, where he was living in Mecca for some time as a Muslim, and he converted to Islam, evidently. But he was a Dutch colonial officer. That's a very interesting person, but I'll stop here there. And to become, Bogolsia wanted to be like him, becoming part of the Muslim Republic des Lettres, the Gelehrten Republic, the Arabic Islamic Gelehrten Republic, to learn everything about Muslim knowledge, Islamic knowledge, living among Muslims and with Muslims. That's important for Goldsie, and that's quite an imperative for my discipline. Should be, at least. He says, quote, "In company with learned persons, I visited coffee houses." I fully agree. And to listen to storytellers, we have a lack here in Vienna for storytellers, evidently, and went to Dervish convents where I could listen to dhikrs. That's what no normal Islamic studies scholars do. At least you shouldn't tell or your colleagues if you are doing it and if you are not a social anthropologist. Okay, but he became acquainted with the famous Algerian, Abdelkader al-Jazairi, the famous fighter against the French colonialists in Algeria, and unsuccessfully, he was exiled to France and then to Damascus. He was a very famous scholar. His writings on Sufism are very important, very complex, I have to admit, and less studies than they would deserve. But maybe it's interesting. Goldsia proclaimed that the Jewish religion may be elevated to a rational level similar to Islam. That's quite a statement to listen nowadays. If we are hearing about Islam, a very irrational religion and things like that. Goldsia gives reports about his many meetings with scholarly or not, and the discussions he had, and especially stressing the positive response he met again and again. Goldsia is the central person in all these discussions. At least, how many time have I is left? Just the organizer?
15 minutes. We're still in time. It's perfect.
I'll try my best, even as a professor. Goldsia tried to continue his intense contact with Muslims, especially learned Muslims in Cairo. He listened to lectures at the Al-Azhar University. And we might say his efforts were successful in this respect, but he met another obstacle. Goldsia was not admitted to Friday prayer at the Al-Azhar Mosque, and that was a very shock to him. He was allowed to pray with Muslims in Damascus, but not in Cairo. Al-Azhar is very special to some. He was, what he really wanted to be, was to be close as Muslim to his Muslim friends as possible, not out of a kind of voyeurism that maybe for some travelers from Europe has been the true reason to at least claim to become Muslims, to be part, to take part in prayers, things like that, or travel to Mecca as Nukurhanya did. At least he turned Goldsia to overcome this obstacle. He turned to wearing Muslim garments and trained himself to be accepted as a Muslim. He was successful and prayed among Muslims. He said, quote, "Never in my life I was more devout than on that exalted Friday." He once even said he has become a Muslim. that was his feeling when he was over when he wasn't there in Cairo and in Egypt and in Syria. But his friends tried to convince him not to do this kind of act again, and he was forced to stay away from the Al-Azhar Mosque and from Friday prayer, much to causing feelings of a, let's say, of a lover who having to stay away from his beloved. A really emotional part of his diary. And it's very clear he felt a deep longing to be integrated into the Muslim society at his when he was over there. And he felt, to some extent, violated in his self-esteem. That's another aspect we have, we shouldn't forget. So the broad interests of Goldseer, inspired by stay in Syria and Egypt, may be illustrated by an article on poems of young people and children in the streets of Cairo, published in 1879 in the Zeitschrifter Deutschen Morgenländischen Gesellschaft. Very well done fieldwork. He was helped by an Egyptian colleague, and as we learn from his diary, this relationship with the Egyptian colleague was evidently based on a cordial relationship, not on this kind of colonial hierarchies in indigenous informer providing information to a Western scholar. That's still widespread among Arabic and Islamic studies scholars, I'm afraid, I have to admit. This attitude is well in line with the critical attitude of Goldseer to Western European colonialism in the Arab world and beyond. We do have many remarks about that one, and his discussion with the French scholar Ernest Renan is quite revealing when he's criticizing the anti-Semitism of Renan and the claim that Muslims are not able to think scientifically at all. They will not never be able to do it. Very short summary. Goldseer was very vocal against this widespread approach in the 19th century in Europe. At least turning from Islam to another religion, I'm not talking about Jewish affairs. At the International Congress of the History of Religions in Paris in September 1900, Christian era, Goldseer gave a lecture on Islamisme, Eparsism, Islam and Zoroastrianism. This lecture may be read as a symptom of another rhizome of ideas contributing to the emergence of Islam beyond he was interested in, beyond his interest in Jewish and Greek ideas who may have contributed to the emergence of Islam. In a very sweeping statement, Goldseer speaks about the Iranian influence on early Islam, for example, about the role, the influence of the Sasanian concept of state, the ancient dynasty of pre-Islamic Iran. Although there are some interesting observations by Goldseer, this sweeping character of his lecture allows for adoption by the German revisionist school of Islamic studies, and that's Luxembourg, Ohlig, and others in Germany, and their claim of a non-Arabian Islam influenced by Syro-Aramaic traditions, etc. It's a long story. But they translated the French lecture by Goldseer into German, since saying, okay, even this venerated scholar said, okay, Islam wasn't there at the time. Muslims claim it wasn't there. We have to admit that in his lecture, and due to his very sweeping statements, He was very close to the tradition of Islamic studies, claiming the right to define what Islam is or was. He was very sometimes influenced by the mood, the intellectual mood in academic circles in Europe at that time, evidently. But that's only a few symptoms of this attitude. So in the very broad view, it's very clear Goetzia was quite out of the mainstream attitude to some extent. One other aspect less known is the interest of Ignaz Goetzia for the Baha'i faith. He wrote some articles on it, and this may be the reason why the then head of the Baha'i community, global community, visited Goetzia in Budapest in 1913, where a Baha'i missionary told us Ebu Goetzia waited on at the Budapest Western Railway Station to welcome this the head of the Baha'i community. There are a few discussion if it maybe it has been another railway station in Budapest, but it's not of great interest for us, I think. Goetzia was has lengthy meeting with Abdul Baha Effendi, the head of the community, and was invited by him to a public lecture and greeted very warm by the audience when he was invited to the introduced to the audience. But context to the Baha'i community didn't continue. Goetzia received a present, a carpet. Okay, the Baha'i are coming from Iran. They are distributing carpets, quite a tradition up to now. Even our a friend of ours here in our district, an Iranian, when we are giving our carpets there to clean, he tries to convince it, oh, please take this carpet. So, but okay, that's another story. Even some cliches came true and come true again and again. But at least to come to conclusion and to ease the mood of our organizer. We may conclude with a sentence from the correspondence, another one of Ignaz Goetzia and Martin Hartmann, a German scholar of Arabic and Islamic studies who died in 1918, Christian era. Goetzia writes, "Machen Sie doch unseren Islam nicht gar zu schlecht. Don't denigrate our Islam." Imagine non-Muslims, Hartmann was a Jew too, and imagine non-Muslims nowadays talking about our Islam. If for Austria, it's a very, very complicated idea to think it becoming real. Goetzia continues, "Verlieben Sie sich die Arier nicht. Don't fall in love with the Aryans." Since Hartmann has some very interesting views, I won't discuss here. Quite a remark worth reminding from the times before World War I and before the Holocaust. That's impossible nowadays, just for that reason. One other remark may be allowed to clarify my approach. If there's any way to study Islam from a non-Muslim perspective, understanding Islam as our Islam, as part of the common human heritage, may not be all the worst approaches we could use. And I promise, last word, it makes scholarly life worth living. So having views less biased than the usual anti-Muslim approaches. But I'm afraid I have another last remark to make. A methodological guideline for non-religious Islamic studies, and that's my approach, may be found in the correspondence between Goetzia and Theodor Noldeke, who died in 1930, Christian era, was a famous German Orientalist and Arabist, famous for his studies on the Quran, still worth reading, by the way. Goldseer wrote in a letter dated May 28, 1910, saying that any claim of a person being Muslim has to be accepted. Quote, as long as they feel themselves as Muslims, we are obliged to accept them as Muslims. Quite simple. For me, this means Islamic studies do not have essentialist claims to define, have not the right even to define what is Islamic. I do know many journalists who asked me, what does Islam say about this or that issue? And I'm saying, oh no, I'm just a professor. I can tell you what Muslims are saying about it. And you may ask them and not me. But okay, it's difficult for journalists to understand. And the very last remark, I'm afraid, and our organizer knows, I have to follow Friedrich Niewöhner, saying it is much more Ignaz Goldseer with Torah and Quran, not between. And that's no offense meant, for sure. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Rulka, for your ideas and thoughts upon the central figure of Oriental studies, Ignaz Goldseer. Go to Professor Susanne Heschel, and then after that we can make a joint discussion and collect all the questions. Professor Heschel.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mohammed Abdelkarim, for organizing this excellent lecture series, and I'm honored to be part of it, and it's good to be here with Professor Loker and speak about the great Ignaz Goldseer. I have a few things to try to contextualize Goldseer, perhaps in some ways that are different from those who are in Islamic studies. My field is Jewish studies and modern Jewish thought. First, I want to point out in the larger picture, the Jewish scholars of Islam have created turning points in the scholarship on Islam. So they're not simply adding to it, but turning points. And by this, I would take Abraham Geiger from the early 19th century, his book from 1833, Was hat Mohammed aus dem Judentum aufgenommen, is a work that many credit with launching the field of Islamic studies. It's a study of the Quran and some of the parallels between passages in the Quran and rabbinic literature. It's more than that, but I'll stop at that point. A second figure who has to be considered is another Jewish scholar named Gustav Weil, who is the person who first attempted to put a chronology into the surahs of the Quran, to organize them chronologically, an effort that Theodor Noldeke took up a bit later and credited him with laying the groundwork for that effort. He also wrote a 5-volume history of the caliphate and a biography of the Prophet Muhammad based on Islamic sources, the first one in Europe to use Islamic sources for this. And then we come, of course, to Ignaz Goldseer, who is especially noted for his work on Hadith and Islamic law. He was an extraordinary scholar, and there are many ways in which we might think about him, contextualize him. And I want to talk about some of those possible contextualizations just to see how multifaceted he was as a person and he was as a scholar. There is, of course, the context of Hungarian Orientalism that's been explored by Katalin Rack and also Andre Gingrich, of course, the uniqueness of Hungarian Orientalism compared to the Orientalisms of other parts of Europe, Germany, France, England, and so forth. And of course, its links to the nationalism of the First World War and the post-World War era when Hungary was essentially dismembered. But there's also another Jewish Orientalism of Europe that was a bit different from European Orientalism. And I would just emphasize that the Jewish Orientalism of Europe, which is unique and which I've written about, also needs to be contrasted with Jewish participation in the Nakhda, that is the Arab Renaissance. And then there is also the question of the reception of European Orientalism among Muslims and Arabs in Turkey, in North Africa, in the Middle East. They too have a voice. not only in those countries, but also because many of them came to Europe to study European methods of Wissenschaft. And Umar Riyad and I have co-edited a volume of articles called Muslim Reception of European Orientalism that begins to explore at least some of those examples. Tahtawi is one figure, for instance, Shidyak is another figure, and so on. And what's striking is that the Arab and Muslim scholars who came to Europe to study Wissenschaft were very critical of European methods in ways that are remarkably similar to the criticisms of the Wissenschaft des Judentums scholars, also of European scholarly methods and assumptions. And both, of course, among other things, were critical of the misunderstanding, perhaps we'd say, of Arabic and Hebrew sources. So then there's another context, which is the context of European scholarly methods that were, in fact, pan-Germanic. You didn't have to live in Germany to write in German. German was the language, for many reasons, of Wissenschaft in the 19th century, at least until 1933, when, of course, academic life was dismembered by Hitler. And in the Wissenschaft des Judentums, it was also German that came to be the dominant language. Although Goldseer wrote many of his articles first in Hungarian, he then translated them into German for publication. And indeed, the main influence, I would argue, on Goldseer was Abraham Geiger. He's credited by Goldseer for his influence, and others have pointed out the parallels, of course. Goldseer writes that it was through reading Geiger's magnum opus of 1857, the Urschrift und Übersetzungen der Bibel in ihrer Abhängigkeit, der Zeit and so forth, it's a longer title than that. But this Urschrift of Geiger, was by reading it, Goldseer says, that he began to understand the philological methods of what's called the Tübingen School from the University of Tübingen that was launched in 1831 by Ferdinand Christian Bauer. And it was a school that developed new radically historicist methods for understanding the origins of Christianity, that is Christianity during the first two centuries. Finally, there's also another context, and that's the context of Judaism. Because Goldseer wrote about Judaism as much as he wrote about, or as well as he wrote about Islam. He was, I would say, as much a Jewish thinker as he was a scholar of Islam. Now, to understand Goldseer in that Jewish context, we might first think about the Hungarian Jews. Jews in Hungary were unique. Unique in the sense that they were dominated by a very reactionary Orthodox Jewish set of rabbis and communities. Right wing, very religious, demanding religiosity from all Jews, and also persecutory. They went after people who were considered to deviate from their understanding of Orthodox Judaism and accused them of heresy. And I'll say a word about that because those charges haunted Goldseer from age 12 through the rest of his life. It's just, I have to say, not clear why Hungarian Jews were so rigidly Orthodox. It's a puzzling question. I've asked many historians of Hungary and I haven't gotten an answer. But at the age of 12, when Goldseer published his first book, a Hebrew book, Sefer Yitzchak, which means the book of Isaac, his Hebrew name, Ignatz in Hebrew, is Yitzchak. He immediately began to suffer from these charges of heresy. Now, just again, the context, Jews were emancipated in Hungary in 1867. Goldseer was then 17 years old. At that point, rabbis, both after the emancipation, but even leading up to it, were being urged by the government to give their sermons in Hungarian and to promote the assimilation of Jews into Hungarian society. Orthodox rabbis considered that to be sinful and contrary to messianic hopes and to piety, belief in God, and so forth. But there were consequences for Jewish education, and that's where Goldseer was affected. That is, until about this point, Jewish education was very male-oriented, 90% boys, not girls. It was entirely religious, was conducted in private Jewish-sponsored institutions. The instruction was given in Yiddish and Hebrew. There was prayer during the course of the day, and religious texts only were taught. Older boys continued, the better boys, smarter boys, continued for Talmud study in the yeshivot, the rabbinical seminaries. But now Jews were being encouraged to enroll in secular schools, and parents who wanted their children to grow up and have a profession, go to university, also realized the importance of that secular education. Goldseer's father, Adolf Goldseer, was a merchant who dealt in leather goods, and he was the son of a merchant. He was well off. Young Ignaz was also influenced by this atmosphere. His diary is full of Hungarian poetry. He sang Hungarian melodies. And because the family was sufficiently well off, Ignaz was able to obtain books and amass a large library. He had a collection of Judaica from his grandfather. And by the time Goldseer was 15 years old, he had a library of 600 volumes. It's considerable. His father kept him to his studies with determination. By the time Goldseer was just 4 years old, he was able to read Hebrew, Hebrew print, and Rashi script, a slightly different alphabet. Age of 5, he had serious study. Age of 12, he started learning Talmud. He went to school. His school education was in German. He finished elementary school at the age of 9 and was enrolled in a Cistercian school. But he skipped the first 3 periods every day to stay at home and study Hebrew texts with a private tutor. His teachers recognized that he was a wunderkind. And a turning point came when Goldseer was 11 years old. His father hired an elderly private tutor, a man named Moses Wolf Freudenberg, to teach Goldseer for several years. Freudenberg was an intellectual, a rationalist, active in what is called the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment. And he raised broad intellectual issues for his pupil. Goldseer praises Freudenberg in his diary, and there's some correspondence between them in Hungarian. He understood that he needed to study the Bible, for example, the book of Job and Psalms, not just for the sake of grammar and traditional belief, but also for their political relevance. That's a point that he makes. Now, at the age of 12, Goldseer went to Pest, part of Budapest, on a trip, and he took with him his own handwritten manuscript that he was going to publish a Sefer Yitzchak. It dealt with the question of prayer. He took it to a printing house, and he presented it to his father and Freudenberg as a surprise. It was written in Hebrew in an imitation of academic language, dedicated to his grandmother. It had a foreword, an introduction, a text with footnotes and quotations in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. This publication outraged the Jews of his town. They thought he was yet another Spinoza, a free thinker. And we should add that in the foreword to the book, Goldseer wrote a challenge and a critique to the Orthodox rabbis. He said that they had misconstrued the purpose of prayer. He criticized their fanaticism. He criticized their reliance on Moshe Isserles, the 16th century Polish rabbi who had written a commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch. He accused them of, quote, blind fanaticism. And he said that Orthodox rabbis are not representing the best interests of Judaism and have too narrow an understanding of Hebrew texts. They are fanatics, he felt. The text also shows us the beginning of Goldseer's interest in the literary nature of texts. He sees connections between prayer, song, and poetry. When he was 40, Goldseer commented that this first work began his so-called evil reputation as a free thinker. But I emphasize this point to show many aspects, of course, his brilliance at a young age, but also to show that Goldseer was, in a sense, caught throughout his life between the Orthodox fanaticism and intolerance of the religious Jewish community in Hungary and the antisemitism that was pervasive in Hungary and that prevented for a long time his appointment to a professorship. He received offers from other universities in Europe and Britain, but he refused to leave Budapest. He never said exactly why, but we can assume it would have been exhausting, would have been very difficult to move his library. And he also would have lost access to the extraordinary libraries of his fellow Orientalists in Budapest. Katalin Rock has described the network of Orientalists who were living in Budapest at the time, within walking distance of one another, and the ability of each to consult the libraries of the others. And of course, it's possible that his wife and two sons also did not want to relocate and start over in a different language. Now, there's also the German context. Goldseer studied in Germany, received a doctorate from the University of Leipzig under Heinrich Fleischer. Fleischer has been written about in several articles by Ismar Schorsch, one of my teachers. Fleischer had many doctoral students, about around 150, and about two-thirds of them were Jewish students. He was extraordinarily open, well-disposed to Jewish scholars, and engaged with them in correspondence, very close. He was very close to Goldseer throughout his life. Fleischer died in 1888. Close, intimate even, in a very friendly and warm way. Fleischer also was one of the founders of the Deutsche Morgenländische Gesellschaft that opened itself to participation to Jewish scholars, including in its journal, the Zeitschrift der Deutschen Morgenländischen Gesellschaft. Jews were able to publish scholarly articles there, whereas they could not in Protestant journals published in Germany. So this was the first opportunity the Jews had to submit their work for publication to a journal that was not published by other Jewish scholars. It was, of course, in Germany that Goldseer came to be acquainted with different trends in German philological methods and in historicist thinking more broadly. There is, of course, the trip to Egypt and Damascus and Palestine that was laden with significance, as we already heard from Professor Lolker. He viewed Islam as a rational religion, as a model for Judaism, if only Judaism could be raised to that high rational level. At the same time, Goldseer writes that he never felt more pious as when he went to prayer in the mosque Friday. And that's striking because I don't know of any Jewish thinker who has written or experienced, maybe not without writing about it, but a Jewish thinker who's gone to a church and stated in this era and stated that he or she never felt so pious as in the church. There was something about the mosque that was different. And I think perhaps some of us are aware of Goldseer's antipathy toward Christianity, which he expressed at times in very strong and even one might say vulgar language. But his admiration for Islam was something quite different. At the same time, it's important for us to recognize that what is governing Goldseer, I would say, throughout his lifetime, and what is really in some sense a marker of modern Jewish thought, is the tension between the rational religion and the inspiring religion. And I'll come back to that point in a moment because that's one of the key issues here, I believe. Now, Josef von Ess has described the favorable reception of Goldseer's work at Al-Azhar University. He was cited in lectures by scholars there, and some of his work was also translated into Arabic, at least until the arrival of members of the Muslim Brotherhood from Syria. I believe it was in the 1930s when the citation of Goldseer fell into disfavor and stopped. Similar kinds of critique, or the reception, let's say, that can be negative as well as positive, but the negative reception of Goldseer is also found in Turkey. For instance, Fuat Sezgin, I don't know how to pronounce his name properly, I apologize, a Turkish name, a theologian, Fuat Sezgin, also wrote very critically of Goldseer. The question is it Goldseer or is it simply historicist method that is being criticized here? In many ways, it's very similar to the criticisms that Goldseer received from the Jewish community of Hungary. Another context that was mentioned briefly is the question of Ernst Renan, the most famous Semiticist of the era, whose 1863 Life of Jesus became internationally known. It was translated into languages around the world, and yet whose demotion by the Roman Catholic Church also gave him the aura of a suffering hero. He was rehabilitated somewhat by 1870. But what Renan wrote about Judaism and Islam was in fact far worse than the challenges he posed to the Catholic Church. And I'll come back to Goldseer's response because I believe it's important. As much as Goldseer struggled against the rigid orthodoxy of Hungarian rabbis, he also struggled against the Orientalist racism he saw in Renan. Goldseer's book, The Mythologies of the Hebrews, was his first rejoinder to Renan. It was a defense of Judaism having mythology. What is mythology? It means a living, breathing, dynamic theology. Renan's study of Semitic languages, published in 1853 to great acclaim, he won the Volney Prize for it by the French Academy, argued that Semites lack mythology because they are instinctually monotheistic. And this is a very important point for us to understand, this question of monotheism, if we want to understand Islamophobia and its origins. Renan's study set a new agenda for many decades and sparked a broader European discussion of the value of monotheism and encouraged a redirection of Christian theology. That is, lacking mythology was no longer viewed as a triumph over paganism, but as a deficit of religion. It reflects the Semites' intolerant and exclusivist nature, Renan argued, and stands in opposition to Aryans in religion, language, and ways of thinking. Compared to Aryans, Semites, he argued, lack scientific and artistic originality. They created no national epic or mythology. They show no ability to think abstractly. And they couldn't organize large governments or military campaigns. Judaism, like Islam, was unable to progress. It was stagnant and developed a rigid legalism. The mantle of the classical prophets of the Hebrew Bible passed to Jesus. There were many critics of Renan. Friedrich Max Müller, in his book Semitic Monotheism, pointed out that if monotheism was a characteristic trait of Jews, why had the ancient Hebrews relapsed into polytheism so frequently? Similarly, Goldseer asked, if Arabs had first been polytheists and then monotheists, how can religion be the product of racial instinct, as Renan argued? But the defenses of Christianity against Renan, such as Müller's, ultimately disengaged it from Judaism in order to affirm the uniqueness of Christian monotheism. Those embracing Renan now began to see the move to polytheism as a source of progress rather than a relapse into evil, so that Christology and Christian dogma were hailed as the transformation of monotheism via polytheism, leaving behind the backward monotheism of the Jews. The Jewish turn to Islam, then, among scholars, came in part to rehabilitate Judaism through linking it with Islamic monotheism. Goldseer's response was to uncover mythology within Judaism and Islam, to insist on the purity of their monotheism linked to ethics and religious law, and demonstrate their progressive development within each religion. And this was in part an agenda set by Geiger that had inspired him. And Geiger's own response to Renan is something that I wrote about in my book on Abraham Geiger. But at the same time that Goldseer is defending Judaism against Renan in his Mythologies of the Hebrews, these were originally lectures that he delivered in Budapest, the Jewish community of Hungary considered his lectures to be heretical. And in fact, the lecture series was stopped before it was ever finished. Now, one other encounter came when Renan gave a lecture in 1833 at the Sorbonne on Islam and science, in which he argued that neither Arabs nor Islam, neither Jews nor Judaism are scientific and capable of philosophical thinking. He spoke of the, quote, the terrible simplicity of the Semitic spirit, closing the human brain to every subtle idea, to every fine sentiment, to all rational research, in order to confront it with an eternal tautology, God is God, end quote. Monotheism, he says, is not a matter of ethics, but simply of arithmetic. And Renaud also denounced Arab scholarship as stemming not from Semites, but rather from rebels against Islam or from Iranians, whom he identified as Aryans. And for this, a debate broke out. He was criticized by Jamal al-Din al-Afghani, a prominent figure of the pan-Islamist movement and a close friend of Goldseer's from their days together in Cairo in 1873-74. And in response, in the course of this debate, Renan simply wrote that al-Afghani lent support to Islam because he was an Afghan, and he proved Renan's own thesis. He's an Afghan and consequently an Iranian, and therefore an Aryan and not a Semite. So the argument was quite racialized. For Goldseer, Renan's attack on Islam was an insult and demonstrated Renan's ignorance of Islam. His insistence on this simplicity of the Semitic spirit that made religion the product of race was dangerous, and Goldseer insisted that the future of Europe depended on refuting Renan's thesis. His speech, The Orientalist Renan of 1894, criticized Renan's work, showing that he had failed to understand Islamic sources and had serious flaws in his analysis and so on. But it was a rather passionate moment and in defense of Islam. And what we see here is how the defense of Islam is simultaneously a defense of Judaism. The issues for Goldseer in both religions are parallel, if not identical. Finally, a word about the influence of Geiger and the Tübingen School and Goldseer's scholarship on the Hadith. European scholarship was focused on questions of origin and authenticity, searching within a text to find its original core and separate it from what could be claimed to be later accretions or additions or interpolations. Hadith, with its attributions by one person to another, plus the legendary nature of some of its claims, fell into the same sort of analysis as, for example, the Gospels of the New Testament. Could a core truth or reality about Jesus's life and teachings be determined from within these four Gospels that often contradict each other's accounts? Put briefly, Geiger's 1833 book on the Quran, demonstrating parallels with rabbinic literature, led to Gustav Weil's History of the Caliphate and questioning of the reliability of the Hadith. For Geiger, the Quran was the source for Muhammad. He didn't go into Hadith, but Gustav Weil in his History of the Caliphate dismissed most of the Hadith on the grounds that they were not reliable as evidence for the era that they claimed to be describing and the people whose teachings they were claiming to voice or describe. There were similar attitudes expressed in the middle of the 19th century by the Austrian Alois Sprenger and the Scottish scholar William Muir. Sprenger noted that a particular tradition could be presented in several different ways, suggesting either forgery or the possibility that a tradition developed over time, thus making Hadith perhaps possible or useful for tracing historical development. Muir, William Muir, followed, insisting that only Quranic surahs and not Hadith were reliable for records of Muhammad's teachings and public life. So such approaches to Hadith reflect the scholarly approaches also to the synoptic problem of the Gospels. How do scholars reconcile differing accounts? Which are authentic words and acts of Jesus or of Muhammad? Can a historical trajectory be demonstrated based on these gospel reports? While Goldseer did not view Hadith as reliable sources for the figures to whom the teachings were attributed, he did view Hadith as important sources for scholars to reconstruct differences in beliefs and tensions within early Islam. His approach echoes that of Geiger, who examined Syriac, Greek, and Aramaic translations of the Hebrew Bible that were translations made in antiquity in order to reconstruct conflicting religious, social, and political tensions within Second Temple Judaism. So the tensions were reconstructed based on the particular translation of a text. How was a word rendered? What does that decision of translation tell us? Just as Geiger's work is based on his assumption that the texts were not divinely revealed, nor were they written down by Moses, Goldseer assumed that the Hadith teachings attributed to Muhammad were not stated by him. I can read you a quote, and I'm coming to the conclusion in a moment. I'll read you a quote from Goldseer in German. Das Hadith führt uns nicht als Dokument für die Kindheitsgeschichte des Islam, sondern als Abdruck der in der Gemeinde hervortretenden Bestrebungen aus der Zeit seiner Entwicklungsstadien dienen. Es bietet ein unschätzbares Material von Zeugnissen für den Entwicklungsgang, den der Islam während jener Zeiten durchgemacht hat, in welchen er aus einander widerstrebenden Kräften, aus mächtigen Gegensätzen sich zu systematischer Abrundung herausformt. I hope you could tolerate my German my bad accent. But my point is that Geiger's methods, seeing the translations, not to see what may have been most would have been original or authentic, but rather to understand historical development, these were applied by Goldseer to his work on Hadith and Sharia, and even on later manifestations of Islam, such as his analysis of Hanafite versus Malachite schools of law, which he saw reflecting a range of social layers. As Geiger had done with rabbinic texts, Goldseer demonstrated the complexity of thought within the Hadith, rather than a unitary view, as was then common. He demonstrated Persian and Greek influences, and also influences from the New Testament and the Old Testament, and he placed Hadith texts within the history of antiquity. Theological victories in the development of Islam were won through the politics of the Sunnah, he argued, and then they were canonized, giving rise to legal scholars and hegemonic practice. The same sort of pattern Geiger had identified in rabbinic law and that Goldseer himself had denounced among the Orthodox rabbis of his day. However, unlike Geiger, who saw Islam's religious and cultural borrowings as a triumph of Judaism, Goldseer saw something novel in Islam, and he fought constantly against the view of Islam as closed and incapable of development. His approach was viewed as radical by many. And in fact, Louis Massignon, the great scholar of Sufism, was led to ask Goldseer what would be left of the Gospels if he applied his own Quranic methods to them. But Goldseer himself did not see his work as in any way destructive. On the contrary, his admiration for Islam became deeply personal. My conclusion. How should we understand the Jewish fascination with Islam and the abundance of Jewish scholars in the field of Islamic studies from 1833 to the present? And I want to suggest a wide range of possible interpretations for this scholarship. The study of Islam, for one thing, was simultaneously a study of Judaism, the nature of religion, for example, but also very particular things such as influences of rabbinic literature on aspects of Islamic texts. These scholars used their knowledge of rabbinic literature to identify points of comparison as a way to demonstrate Judaism's influence in the Arabia of antiquity. There's also a politics to scholarship. Goldseer defined Islam as submission to God, a phrase whose resonance in the era of European imperialism has to be understood not as a form of human subjugation, but rather as an expression of human identification with the will of God. Imperialist conquest of the world is for the sake of God. In other words, let's think about the imperialism of scholarship, as Edward Said used to point out to us. The alliance of Judaism with Islam was also part of an ongoing triangulation created by modern Jewish thinkers. Jacob Emden, an Orthodox rabbi in Altona in the late 18th century, viewed all three religions as a community for the sake of heaven. With Christianity and Islam adhering to the seven Noahide commandments, for example. But 19th century Jewish thinkers either allied Judaism with Islam against Christianity or allied Judaism with Christianity against Islam. The three after that were not placed on the same path. This depiction of Islam as a religion of rationalism, science, and toleration, in contrast to Christianity, which was the common view, Christianity is a religion of dogma, intolerance, and persecutions, was a Jewish response to Christian contempt for Judaism. And that contempt arose because Christianity could not fathom religions that rejected intolerance. In Muslim Spain, Jews lived a golden age. In Christian Europe, they were murdered or expelled. The depiction of Islam in the German Enlightenment is complex, but Gotthold Lessing helped to popularize the tradition that Islam is a more reasonable religion than Christianity because it does not depend for its truth on miracles and prophecies. This is depicted in his popular play, Nathan der Weise, but also discussed in his work on theology. Can historical events prove revelation? Can miracles be the basis for religion and ethics? These ideas were particularly influential among Jewish thinkers, starting with Moses and Mendelssohn. And it led, of course, to the problem of revelation. What was the ethical implication if a special truth was revealed by God to only a few people, whether it was the ancient Israelites or the Muslims or the Christians? And if a revelation reveals nothing that cannot be grasped by reason, what's the point of revelation? Islam was in the same boat as post-Enlightenment Jewish thought, and Jewish thinkers recognize that. If their claims regarding one God could be achieved through reason, then their revelation was simply a matter of a few laws and religious practices. And if obeying those laws was a form of submission to divine authority, the religion was not, in Kantian terms, moral. It was heteronomous and not autonomous. Goldseer recognized that these were theological problems shared by Judaism and Islam. Surrounded by hard-nosed Orthodox rabbis, his rebellion was directed against them, whereas Islam was elevated by him into a kind of ideal essence of rational religion. But finally, I want to emphasize that I believe Goldseer wanted more than rational religion. Yes, he wanted a rational religion without miracles, without supernatural claims of resurrection, without dogma, no virgin mother, and so on. But he also wanted to be moved spiritually. He wanted his heart touched. He wanted an elevation of his spirit that he found in the mosque, not in the synagogue. How to achieve a balance? Can a rational religion also touch the heart? The dilemma represents the quiet voice that began to disturb Central European Jews committed to modernity, and it reached a peak after World War II. Does the purification of religion, of everything anti-rational, of all dogma, ultimately lead to a mechanistic, even boring set of rituals, and a bland set of theological principles? These, I believe, were the questions motivating Goldseer and worrying Goldseer. It's not that he came up with a response, with an answer, but he struggled with the question, both in terms of Judaism and in terms of Islam. And what he wrote about both religions resonated and echoed in both religions. Thank you.